This is At Your Cervix, the podcast where pelvic health physiotherapists Emma Brockwell and Gwanya Donnelly talk to incredible guests who help lift the lid and bust the myth on all things pelvic health. Welcome back to episode 13 of series one, and this is our last episode of this series. We have had such a great time recording this podcast, and Gwanya and I really want to extend our thanks hugely to the incredible experts that have joined us and shared their knowledge with us, and obviously the women as well who have shared their pelvic health journeys with us. Really, we're forever grateful, and we really hope you have enjoyed every minute that you've listened to. Our last episode, we leave you with a rather special guest, world-renowned pelvic health physiotherapist, Michelle Lyons. Both Gwanya and I have attended numerous Michelle Lyons courses, and I'm yet to meet a pelvic health physiotherapist that hasn't been on one of Michelle's courses. Michelle is incredible. She knows everything, it seems, about pelvic health, and we really had to cherry pick the topic we were going to talk about today because she could share with us so much. But today she drops loads of knowledge bombs, busts loads of myths about hormones, period, the menopause, and it really is such an incredible way to end the series. So without further ado, I leave you to listen to the really incredible Michelle Lyons, and we really hope to see you back for series two, which we hope will launch in the autumn. For now, enjoy.
Hello, everybody. And what better way to close season one of At Your Cervix, the podcast, than with a world-renowned physiotherapist, Michelle Lyons. Michelle is from Ireland, and she's actually from the centre of Ireland, somewhere in Mullingar. So I want to hand over to Michelle to tell us a little bit about herself, and then we can get stuck in.
Thanks a million. I'm absolutely beyond delighted to be here today. I'm loving what you ladies are doing in the world of physio and women's health, and now podcasting as well. So I live in Westmead, pretty much in the middle of nowhere in Ireland, and I qualified as a physio. I was doing the maths this morning nearly 30 years ago, but I've added to my toolbox over the years. So I've just finished a postgrad in health coaching and nutrition, and I've qualifications in yoga and Pilates and mindfulness. And I did a postgrad last year as well, being a glutton for punishment, on innovation, because I really think we need to start innovating about how we're thinking and talking and teaching and working with women's health. So I feel like it kind of reinvigorated my passion. And I'm really excited to be here today and be really nerdy with you two and talk all about women's health.
Yeah. Wow. Listen, we love it because you are our superstar guru pelvic physio. So this is very exciting for us. We could talk to you about anything pelvic health because you do actually know everything.
It's true. That's really not true at all, Emma.
It feels like that. We shouldn't be selfish and take too much of your time up. So we thought we'd focus things a little bit more around hormones, periods, menopause, if that's okay.
Brilliant.
It's so topical at the moment. Why not talk about it, I say. So what we really want to know is, what should every woman know about hormones and periods, in your opinion?
Well, this is my current kind of passion topic to talk about, because menopause has been in the news quite a bit lately. But which is brilliant, obviously. But I really think that in order to truly understand menopausal health, you need to understand menstrual health. And I still feel like periods are a bit of a taboo, you know, despite the fact that 51% of the people on the planet, you know, have periods every month, you know, just about, unless, you know, depending on their type of contraception, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's basically something that everybody with a uterus and, you know, ovaries and a vagina is going to be going through some aspect of this journey. And it's one of the key things that I would love to get across to women and to the physios who work with them as well, is ask about periods, first of all. That's the most important thing, because ACOG, back in 2005, they first started talking about it. But then in 2015, they acknowledged that menstrual health is actually the fifth vital sign. it's as important as the other vitals like temperature and pulse and respiratory rate. But how many of us, even those of us who are working in women's health, you know, if we're talking about pregnancy or postnatal health or pelvic pain, are we always asking the right questions about periods and menopausal health, or menstrual health, sorry? Because one of the key signs that you're actually entering into perimenopause is that your periods start getting irregular. And I would even go as far as to say as that menopause itself doesn't really matter. It's perimenopause, the 10 years leading up to menopause, because all menopause means is it's literally a snapshot in time. It's been 12 months since you've had a period. Now you're postmenopausal. So it's perimenopause and postmenopause that are actually really the key areas for us to address. But unless you're tracking your periods, how are you going to be tuned into the fact whether or not they are getting erratic? Are they getting longer? Are they getting shorter? Because estrogen is just this amazing, amazing chemical that has about 400 different functions in the female body. Of course, men have some estrogen as well, but we're focused on women's health here today. So estrogen affects muscles, tendons, ligaments, obviously bones, hearts, brains, mood, digestion, everything. But particularly, for those of us who are passionate about pelvic health, it's going to affect bladder, bowel, sex, pain. So it really, I think, needs to be more front and center to our conversations about women's health. But for a long time, I don't remember the menstrual cycle really being discussed in detail in any women's health course that I went to. It was all let's jump into pregnancy. And yes, progesterone and estrogen change during pregnancy and they drop after you have your baby. But we're not really, I think, as clued in to the waxing and waning of hormones throughout the menstrual cycle and the different effects that's going to have on us, whether we're an athlete or whether we're a postnatal mom, whether we're perimenopausal, understanding what our hormones do for us and how to look after them, and really give our brains and our ovaries and our uteri the support they deserve, I think is absolutely vital.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's so much packed into one thing there, Michelle. What an opening question. Good work, Emma. But I love the fact that you touched on perimenopause, because I think this is even a term that a lot of our listeners will not be familiar with. And
yeah,
I don't think people realize that perimenopause actually starts much younger than we think. Like officially, technically, I'm 35. So I've entered that stage where perimenopause can start to happen at any stage now. And so yeah, I think people don't realize that they should be tracking symptoms and should be tracking cycles and being aware of it at this phase of their life, and it's not just something that happens down the line.
That's just it, Grania. So if you're tracking your period every month, and whether you're a pen and paper girl or you just jot it down in the calendar, or there are loads of great free apps out there now that you can just type in the start of your period, the end of your period, any symptoms that you're having, I think if you're in the habit of monitoring those cyclical changes on a month-to-month basis for the 40 years or so, if we think that the average age of onset of menstruation is about 12 and the average age of menopause is 52, that's 40 years of really valuable information that we get every month about our hormonal health. And oftentimes that premenstrual into period phase is a great insight into what's going to happen to us in that perimenopausal transition, which, as you said, can last 10 or 15 years before that final period. And that's often the time when women have most of the symptoms that we actually associate with menopause. It could be the hot flushes, it could be the night sweats, it could be the weight gain, particularly that central weight gain, a little bit more aches and pains. We know, for example, that gluteal tendinopathy, it affects 1 in 4 women in their 50s. And we think it's probably due to decreasing levels of estrogen. Tendons love estrogen. And when you take that away, when you take their favorite drug away, they don't like that very much. So you have to be really aware of the systemic effects of hormones like estrogen and progesterone. But perimenopause is really that transition. It's kind of like a reverse of puberty. We're going up and down. It's a little bit more roller coastery than maybe our menstrual cycles have been over the previous 40 years, if you are, quote unquote, the average woman. But it's all about, I can't remember, it was one of the management gurus said, what you measure, you can manage. So a lot of this is really about getting clued into yourself and really being aware, in the same way that we tell everybody to, you know, to do a breast check every month, to do a vulvar self check. How are you feeling on a day-to-day basis? And are there any cyclical patterns emerging? Whether you're 15, 25, 35, or 45, your body is always cycling through different things. And I would say my goal is to really get across the message that every woman needs to be an expert on herself, because there are some things that, yeah, we see in the literature about, you know, the effects of estrogen and athletic performance. But what all of these studies conclude with is that N equals one. Every woman has her own individual story. And then how can you optimize your patterns to feel good? Because at the end of the day, it's what we all want, isn't it? To feel happy and healthy and good in ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on that note, how would you optimize to have a healthy cycle? Because I certainly, if I'm just thinking personally, I don't think I've ever really had a very healthy cycle. It's always been very irregular. And there's certainly been reasons around that, which I've probably never really discussed before. I used to have quite a significant eating disorder. And I don't ever really think that I my cycle ever really got happy after that. And I just wonder how you start getting healthy with your cycle. Have you got any tips for anyone that's maybe listening?
Absolutely. So if you know, we've ever had a significant conversation, you will know that one of the things that I'm obsessed with is good bowel health. And it is literally one of the most important things that you can do for hormonal health. If you are constipated, you're going to have hormonal imbalance. If you're not eating enough, you're going to have hormonal imbalance. Because if we start off at the mouth end of the tube, if we think of our digestive system as a tube, if you're not eating enough calories for your energy expenditure, your brain has to decide where it's going to spend its available energy. It has to budget. And it's never going to choose reproductive health, because it would be disastrous for you to get pregnant if you don't have enough energy going on. So it shuts down ovulation, so you stop having periods. And that can, for some women, and particularly we see this in our female athletes with red S, you know, they stop having periods. They think it's normal. It just means it's a sign they're training hard. It means that if you're not ovulating and having those ebbs and flows of estrogen and progesterone, that can have, unless you take charge of the situation, medium to long-term effects on bone health, on heart health, and then down the line, even on brain health. So we might see a lot of younger female athletes with stress fractures, for example, and some of these can actually be career-ending. But just general energy availability, cognitive function, and then, of course, estrogen is going to affect endothelial function as well, because estrogen is vital for heart health. So we want to think about how we're eating and what we're eating. All of our sex hormones are made from healthy fats. So cholesterol has a bad name, but we need healthy fats to make hormones. So that's an important consideration, first of all. But then we need to excrete what we don't need, because your liver is this great clearinghouse for hormonal health. And your liver is kind of monitoring what's going on at a hormonal level, and it's processing. And it's sending down excess hormones a little bit into your bladder, but mostly into your bowel. So if you're not having regular, happy, healthy bowel movements, a lot of those excess hormones can get reabsorbed back into the system again. And then you can have this relative imbalance of estrogen, which is going to be important if you have like an estrogen-driven issue like endometriosis or fibroids. So a lot of this comes back to getting the basics right. Are you eating well? Are you moving well? Because that's great for bowel health. Are you having happy, healthy, regular bowel movements? Are you sleeping well? Vital for good hormonal health. And are you managing your stress well? So if we're stressing all the time, we can convert a lot of our sex hormones, particularly progesterone, into stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. And that just keeps revving the engine as well. And our hormonal systems don't like that. So it sounds almost kind of glib or blasé to say just eat well, sleep well, move well, manage your stress well. But those are actually the key components for good hormonal health. But again, being aware of all of these things and measuring and keeping an eye for any patterns that are emerging are you having a period every month? You know, are you having really painful periods? Because pain with periods isn't normal. And that's something that we also have to get out there as well. Painful periods that keep you out of work or school are not normal. And that needs to be followed up and checked out, because we know that 1 in 10 women worldwide have endometriosis. And so many of them, you know, it takes multiple years and multiple providers for them to find a solution to this disease, because women have been trained to accept painful periods. And just to really, I think a lot of us are very dissociated from our bodies. And I think learning more about how we work, you know, again, another thing that I'm very fond of saying is that a lot of us know more about how our phones work than we do about how our bodies work, particularly our ovaries and our brains. And I would just love to see, I mean, like, to be honest, girls, like, when was the last time you ever used trigonometry since you left school?
No.
But like, you know, these are the bodies that we live in. Like, wouldn't it be great if in school we were taught how our bodies actually worked, about menstrual health, about eating well, about all these life skills?
Yeah.
You know, I just think we've maybe got the focus a little bit wrong here. And yeah, come the revolution, it'll all be different.
I do agree with you, though, because like when you're talking about things like menstrual health, which starts on average at age 12, if we're thinking of that huge 40-year span on average, that's a huge window that we need to track. And one of the things that I think really needs to change is that even across healthcare, our colleagues who don't specialize in pelvic health need to be more aware of periods and their impact, because that person coming in with musculoskeletal related pain symptoms could be related to their menstrual health, to their bowel health, and how many of them are asking those questions. It tends to be taboo. It tends to be brushed upon. It tends to not be considered as anything relevant, really. And it could be the big elephant in the room that needs to be explored.
I think so, like particularly with athletes, you know, those athletes, and it's not just about disordered eating. It might just be that they're not taking in enough energy relative to their demands. So they're not on that spectrum of disordered eating, but they're training really hard and they haven't got the reserve to meet that demand. So not only are they not having periods, but, you know, maybe if they're on the pill, that's been kind of masked or nobody's asking them about it, but they're picking up all these little niggly injuries, you know, and they're just not feeling good in themselves. And I think really getting back to basics, like asking about this fifth vital sign, about their periods and their menstrual health, can really give us an insight into really something that is modifiable. It's a huge amount of data available to us every month about how we're doing in terms of just general homeostasis, you know, because it's a great reflection of how your brain and your ovaries and your whole body biochemistry is working together to give you optimal health and performance.
So then what's your view, Michelle, on female athletes using contraceptive pills to manage their period so that they're obviously not having a heavy period on the big day, on the big competition day?
Yeah, so absolutely. Like, I mean, you know, that's, we have to look at the reasons that athletes are using the pill, and some of them are using it for contraceptive purposes, but a lot of athletes are using it, you know, just to manage the timing of their cycle. Because like, for example, in rowing, you know, you're out in the water for 6 to 8 hours at a time. You know, do you want to be out there, or you're running the marathon? And there was a runner a couple of years ago who decided to free bleed as she did the marathon, because, you know, she found that wearing a cup or a tampon or a pad was just too distracting. So she was just going to, and it raised eyebrows all over the world. But what we do know from the literature is that oral contraceptive pills can somewhat trivially reduce performance. Now, trivial for some athletes is really important if it means a place on the podium.
Yeah, so fine, it's those real extra seconds count, don't they?
Absolutely. For most women, it's not going to be a significant performance differentiator. But we are starting to look, you know, a little bit more at maybe some of the long-term effects of suppressing your own hormones and putting in exogenous hormones. Now, the pill has been one of the most key elements in terms of advancing women's freedom from a social perspective. And I would never judge anybody for taking the pill, because for some women, it can be an absolute game changer in terms of managing painful periods, mood, even acne. But it's not dealing with the root causes of what's going on. So it can be, for some women, it can be a good way just to do a reset, just maybe 3 months, but really look at what's going on from all those base factors that we've talked about. I think the longer and the later you take the pill, that's when the pros and cons maybe start to get a little bit more to the con side rather than the pro. So the jury is still out in terms of definitive research, but ultimately what the pill is doing, it's suppressing your own ovulation and it's giving you synthetic hormones so that you're at this kind of steady level the whole year round. But if you are an athlete at high level, there is some evidence that it can decrease your performance.
Very interesting. Go ahead, Emma, were you going to say something there?
I was going to ask you then, if what are your thoughts? If obviously the big thing when you have your 6 week GP check, after you've had a baby, should be a thorough check. But I would say, if I'm thinking about my own, so that I keep it very specific and not generalised, the main question I got asked was, do I want to go on contraception? And I wonder, are we benefiting? I mean, obviously, we don't. I'm sure women don't want to fall pregnant very soon after having had their baby. That wouldn't suit most women. But do you think we put too much emphasis on that? Do you think we should give women longer to fall back into their natural cycle before we start thinking about synthetic hormones again, or does it have no consequence, do you think, to them at all?
It's one of those hard to know situations, because there isn't any literature or research really to say yay or nay. Like, we know, for example, that for women who are breastfeeding after they give birth, that generally that's going to keep your estrogen levels quite low postnatally, because it's nature's way of making sure you don't get pregnant again, but it's not foolproof. But a lot of women who, as many women will attest to, but what that can mean is, if you've got very, very low circulating estrogen, you can have quite an issue with dryness. So if you're wanting to return to intercourse, that can be an issue. And you can try, you can do things like lube and VM. But for a lot of women, going on topical estrogen when they're postnatal is a way that they deal with that. And that's a slightly different kettle of fish, because we know that generally there's very little, there is some, but there's very little systemic absorption of topical estrogen. So the current thinking is that we wait until the milk flow has been well established, and then you can use topical estrogen if it's necessary. But there will be some systemic absorption, but much less than if you're taking it, orally, or even through a patch, through, the transdermal application. But do we actually definitively know what effect all of this is having on us long term? No. Again, is it a top priority? I would say, are you focused on, again, nutrition, movement, sleep, and stress management? Because those are all key areas for postnatal women, particularly, as well as the rest of us. So the short answer would be, I don't know the early effect of oral contraceptives on really early postnatal women, but we do know that there will be some.
Yeah.
We just don't know how that's going to affect the long-term output.
So many unanswered questions, aren't there? When you think, as you say, 51% of the population having periods, and we don't know so many answers because research hasn't been done. And I think it's fair to say that we're seeing improvements in that. There are some real key researchers now.
Yes.
Kirsty Elliott-Sale and Kelly McNulty.
Kelly McNulty.
yeah, for sure. We both love Kelly McNulty. I mean, they're doing cracking work. But it's sad that it's only happening now.
Really,
let's be honest.
But I think if you do, I was reading an article just the other day comparing the amount of research looking at erectile dysfunction, which affects 19% of women, versus PMS, which affects 89% of all women.
And 90% of men?
Sorry, no. So PMS affects 90% of women, but erectile dysfunction affects less than 20% of men.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's exponentially more research being done right now on erectile dysfunction than there is
on
PMS.
The man's world we live in. Like, that's what we always say. Any of these symptoms women have, if a man had it, it'd be on the 5 o'clock news. Oh, you know what I mean? Like, these things we feel they're still taboo, yet they'd be shouted out from the rooftop.
So, but that's one of the barriers. So again, talking about periods, not accepting painful periods as the norm is a really important message to get out there. But I think just normalizing that conversation and also looking at the wider ripples of stats like that and statements like that, because Joanne Parsons did a study that was in BGSM fairly recently looking at ACL injuries, because women have far more ACL injuries than men. And, you know, for a long time, it was just blamed on estrogen, because we know that there's going to be more ACL injuries when estrogen is high, because estrogen is anabolic. So it causes muscle growth, but it makes tendons and ligaments less stiff. So when your estrogen is high, that, you know, you're at an increased risk. But what she and her team were saying in their paper is it's not just about the estrogen. We also have to look at how we're training female athletes as well. Are they doing as much strength and conditioning work? You know, and that was actually one of the key messages that I took from her paper as well. It's not just about the estrogen. It's about the wider societal way that we treat female athletes as well. So all the themes that are emerging from people like Kirsty Elliott Sales and Kelly McNulty's research is that, yes, hormones matter, but they're not the be-all, end-all either. We also have to look at what's going on from a sociocultural perspective as well into the attitudes around periods, but also how we're training female athletes.
One of the things I was thinking of when you were talking about breastfeeding and cycles, like, obviously, as you said, for the majority of women, their cycle will be delayed in coming back if they're breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. And how do we as clinicians, like, how do we track or monitor whether someone's having nearly sporadic or like having any sort of impact in their cycle if they're ongoing? Because some women will be breastfeeding, get their period back at 4 weeks. Other way people, I feel like I didn't have a period for 7 years because between I was either pregnant or breastfeeding. but and it's funny because I wondered, would it be quite irregular when it eventually came back? And yet I'm using one of those apps you talked about, which I do recommend because I actually get it triggering me when it's obviously predicting my cycle from previous cycles. And it's then looking at asking me for symptoms even in the run-up to it to see if I have any symptoms. It's really interesting. So then I'm always like, oh yeah, okay, I should be due my period now. And it is coming regular, so it's quite nice for me to know that is fitting into a regular cycle again. But for someone like me, if I was attending a clinic and someone was asking me, when have you had your last cycle, and I was like, oh well, you know what, I've either been breastfeeding or pregnant for the last 5-6 years, so I haven't really had any cycles, would that not flag a kind of like, oh, hold on a wee minute? Like, how do we know when you should have it back?
Yeah, well, that's the key question, isn't it? Like, you know, for some women, you know, that it will come back within 4 to 6 weeks. But if you're going on the pill at that point, you know, that's going to have an effect on your cycle coming back again. If you're not eating well, if you're not getting enough sleep, that's going to affect your cycle coming back as well. So it opens the door, I think, to instead of just zooming in, it opens the door to kind of a wider lens view of what's actually happening big picture in somebody's life, you know. How were your periods before you got pregnant, you know? With previous pregnancies, how long did it take your cycle to come back again? Is this different or is this the norm for you and your body? You know, what are your levels of stress like? Are you eating well? Are you getting enough sleep? Are you getting enough support? You know, are you a smoker? Because we know that's like disastrous in terms of ovarian health. So there's a rabbit hole that you can go down, but it's a jumping off point to start having these conversations and start bringing things into that frame of reference. Because like, Grania, if you're using the app and even you're finding it's triggering, it's like, oh yeah, you know, like you live and breathe women's health day in, day out.
Yep.
And even for you, it's like an oh yeah moment.
Yeah, I was literally like, has that come around already? Oh yeah, I must keep an eye out. I'm going to be having my cycle soon. And it's like, I love even the fact it's asking, are you having any symptoms? Because I'm like, oh, that's so good for people. Because I'm nearly thinking of patients and thinking that's good that it's looking to track those so that they can keep that. So that if they're ever going to a clinic, they can look back and answer a consultant and go, well, actually, this is the pattern of symptoms that I'm having. But one of the things I'm really loving that you're saying is nearly that approach. Em and I have talked in a few papers that we've been doing recently about a whole systems approach. And I think this takes, whether we're talking about periods or we're talking about women's health in general, taking that whole systems approach and looking at how different factors affect each other is so key. And I think it's really empowering for anyone who's not working within the field of pelvic health to feel that they can broach and ask questions about this. And at the very least, they can look and make sure, are people exercising well, eating well, sleeping well, because that's the bread and butter of a lot of our healthcare approaches. So you still have something to do and something to implement there. So that's really, really interesting, Michelle. Thank you.
Yeah, and just, I think, thank you for that. how can we make this a normal coaching question for, the coaches and different sporting teams as well?
Yeah.
You know, how can we destigmatize these conversations so that a male coach is comfortable asking a female athlete about her cycle, without any of the baggage or the squirming that might come with it? It's not that long ago when you saw ads for sanitary products on television that they used blue dye, because using red dye would be too confrontational. It might actually acknowledge the fact that, half the people on the planet bleed every month. So
when you put it like that, it sounds so laughable, doesn't it?
It's bonkers. You know,
blue dye. I forgot those adverts existed. Yeah.
It's not that long ago, Emma.
No, it really isn't. You're talking 3 or 4 years ago,
Yeah.
Craziness, utter craziness. But people would have been offended if the red dye had been used.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. They would have freaked out,
Go figure. But this is, it's interesting because we've spoken to English Institute of Sport, and they obviously have more of a drive now to promote menstrual health. And that's across the board, so that their coaches are getting the training as well. But it's interesting that, again, when 2021, and it's only really, I think, in the past 2 or 3 years that this angle has been taken. There's still stigma around it. We've spoken to some of the athletes as well. And there's still this, I probably wouldn't speak to my coaches about it, especially if they're men, because why would they want to know that exists?
Yeah.
But it's about breaking down barriers and changing the narrative around this whole subject. It's essential.
Well, I think for higher level athletes particularly, it can make, just getting optimal menstrual health right. I mean, the thing is, every woman's going to have her own menstrual cycle. So we can't, for example, tailor the Olympic Games around individual menstrual cycles, when are you going to be performing at your peak? We'll have your event then, I mean, that's not going to work.
That would be ideal.
Wouldn't it be lovely in a female-centric world? But the thing is, though, what every woman, whether she's an elite athlete, and I think we're all athletes in our own way, even if we're not on the Olympic podium, we're all busy women. But I think knowing how you tend to feel at certain times of your cycle might allow you better leeway in planning. So for example, if you know that in the week before your period, progesterone's quite high, you might be prone to a bit more constipation. What can you do about that? Are you eating plenty of fruit and cooked veg, for example? But when your period kicks in, then prostaglandin levels rise because we want to help that uterus, shed its lining. And that can make you switch over to more of a diarrhea tendency because there's so much, you're basically bathing in prostaglandins in your pelvis. So that's going to affect your bowel as well. And a lot of women become more prone to diarrhea around the start of their period. So what can you do to that? Well, maybe avoiding, food triggers for you. It could be spicy food. It could be a lot of fruit for you at that point, and just to know yourself what you tend to do. Like the first half of your cycle, estrogen is starts off low when you've got your period. And then as you move through that follicular phase just before ovulation, estrogen starts ramping up. And you feel like you want to be out there, and estrogen is anabolic. So it's a great time to do a bit of strength training because coming up to ovulation, estrogen is high, testosterone is high. So you're going to, that might be when you lift your PB, But then as you move past ovulation, estrogen starts to drop off and progesterone starts to rise. your temperature might go up a bit. So that's important if you're competing, you know, in a warmer climate. It's going to be important from a hydration perspective. You shift from being more efficient, at carb metabolism in the first half of your cycle to fat oxidation in the second half of your cycle. Mm-hmm. But you might find your appetite also increases because progesterone is rising during that second half of your cycle. Estrogen starts coming up a little bit as well. But progesterone, like the clue is in the name, progest, it wants to get you pregnant. You know, it assumes that you are pregnant. So you start, you know, you might have increased appetite. It's laying down, you know, it's helping estrogen lay down that lining of your uterus in case you are pregnant. So that's when maybe endurance might be a better task for you to focus on the second half of your cycle. Again, N equals one, you know, always. And it's knowing what works for you. But just thinking about just some general trends and the effects of hormones that we do know about and how to make your cycle work for you. That's really the message, isn't it?
It is. That's clever. I like that. I really like that. And I think if women had a little bit more education around that, that would be just so incredibly empowering and actually for many women life-changing. So I don't think, certainly where I live, I don't think I would be able to access that level of education from my GP because I don't think perhaps they've received that education yet. But I'm aware that you do a huge amount of courses for professionals and coaches, which we'll talk about and wave the flag for at the end. But do you do any courses for women so that they can learn more about their cycle and how to optimize what's happening?
Yeah, I'm working on something along those lines now. Just something that is more kind of public facing rather than professional facing, because I think sometimes as women's health aficionados, we can live in our own little bubbles and we assume people know things.
Yeah. Very much so.
And, you know, it's actually, I think like the title of your book really hit the nail on the head. Why did no one tell me? Because we assume that everybody knows these things and go see a physio, you know? But I think that's our job is, you know, I've accused our profession sometimes in the past of being a bit too vagina centric, but we have to kind of look at the whole person attached to that vagina as well and everything else that's going on. But then we have to take that knowledge and we have to, you know, go to the schools, go to the sports clubs, you know, go on local radio in the press and just really start normalizing these conversations, you know, because that's how we, you know, we empower people through educating them, you know, and having these conversations and taking away the scare factor, you know, and what's going on with their own bodies.
Yeah, you just actually, why not just write a book?
Okay, then.
Okay then, done.
I'm sure you have got lots of time to do that.
Yes, Emma, and as you know how easy that is just to sit down and write a book.
Not a problem. I'll put you in touch with my editor. My goodness, she's delighted. I think I might actually do that. Everyone can thank me for doing that once they get that book. We've kind of touched on menopause a little bit throughout this, but let's kind of switch over to the menopause. So you probably said it, but let's say it again. What is menopause and why is it happening?
Okay. So menopause, all menopause means is it's been 12 months since you've had a period. Boom. That's it. So it's literally just that snapshot in time and now you're postmenopausal. So for me, the key things to think about are the perimenopausal transition, which can be that 10 to 15 years up until your last period, and then life after menopause. Because once we move past menopause, hormonally, things are going to be fairly steady. And we're dealing with the issues of aging as well, you know. Perimenopause is really interesting because it's kind of like I heard somebody describe it and I thought it was a really good description of your ovaries are they're slowing down. Sometimes you have a period where you've ovulated, sometimes you have an anovulatory cycle. And your ovaries are kind of like having this going out of business sale. So some months there's estrogen all over the place, you're flooded with it. And then other months, crickets, you know, nothing happening. And for many women, it's that up and down roller coastering, never quite knowing what's going to happen. that can be the most upsetting part of it. Because, you know, obviously your temperature regulation gets thrown off a little bit. And, you know, in most of the research studies, you know, you ask women what the most bothersome symptoms of menopause are. They'll usually start out with the hot flushes, the night sweats, and the disturbed sleep. And of course, then that makes everything bigger and worse. So the ripples, you know, go down the line. We do have to think about heart health, which is the biggest killer of women worldwide. It's not breast cancer. It's heart health. It's heart disease and heart attacks. And that's still poorly recognized because the signs and symptoms of a woman having a heart attack are different from a man. So for many women, the first symptom of a heart attack is death. And, you know, I'm not trying to be glib or funny here because it's not recognized in time that it is actually a heart attack. Estrogen is really cardioprotective. It's brain protective. It's bone protective. Women have dementia twice as many women have dementia as men have, because your brain loves estrogen. When you take that away, that's when the cracks start to show. Estrogen's really anti-inflammatory. Too much of it is not a good thing either. But it's all about, you want to keep your ovaries happy and healthy for as long as you can. And you want to really capitalize, hopefully the whole way through your life, particularly in perimenopause, so you can set yourself up for happy and healthy aging postmenopausally, in terms of bones, brains, but also muscles, metabolic health, breast health, all of those other things, because they're all affected by the changing levels of estrogen. Mm-hmm. So perimenopause, up and down, roller coaster. Menopause, snapshot in time. Life after menopause is we're operating at generally much lower levels of endogenous hormones, which can mean issues around, you know, vaginal dryness, mood, different issues like that. But we're not having the roller coastering. And, you know, the fact of the matter is hormone therapy has come on so much over the past 10 years. But I think, you know, like the whole menopause documentary with Davina that came out a couple of weeks ago really opened up an interesting conversation about still some of the stigma around hormone therapy, because we don't talk about menopausal health enough and in real terms as well, you know, as women telling each other the truth.
And fear around it. There's a lot of fear around hormone
replacement. Yes. Well, there's a lot of fear around aging in general.
Yeah. No, and it's like, there's just a lot of misinformation out there. And that's, you sometimes think, as you say, we live in that bubble. I sometimes think everybody knows this because certain things have been debunked long ago. And then you still meet people in your clinic who are nearly go mad as fact because their neighbor's friend told them this, you know, or they looked on Google and you're like, not in this day and age.
I know. And especially like the big one really is still the link, the purported link between hormone therapy and breast cancer.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, you know, somebody says that to me and I'm like, so do you take a glass of wine at all? Or, you know, would you have any alcohol ever? And they're like, yeah. And I go, well, you realize that there's a much, 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 much higher link between alcohol and breast cancer, not to mention alcohol and dementia, than there is between hormone therapy and breast cancer. Like, oh no, because that doesn't make the headlines. But it's more so than sugar or caffeine or any of the other kind of, you know, devils that we like to you know, paint black, you know, every so often. Alcohol is really a conversation that a lot of women at perimenopause and menopause have to have with themselves, because it's been, you know, kind of one of the downsides of the popularity of the Mediterranean diet. And I'm sorry for anybody listening to this right now who loves their daily glass of red wine, because it's good for me. If you're a woman, it's probably not. It's probably not. I'm sorry. The occasional glass, but like, again, are you doing everything else right? The occasional glass, how comfortable are you with risk? But like, if you're a woman with a history of breast cancer who is suffering terribly with the side effects of breast cancer treatment, particularly if you're on hormonal therapies like tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors, it is, you know, it's really worth having a conversation about the judicious use of estrogen therapy, your particular situation, risk and reward, because for some women, the quality of life is just atrocious, you know, in that sort of scenario. And it's really important that we get accurate information out, you know, because from a pelvic health perspective, like the research does show that if you compare topical estrogen and you compare pelvic rehab, for bladder issues, for example, they both do quite well by themselves. But when you put topical hormone therapy together with skilled pelvic rehab, the combination of those approaches blows each approach by themselves out of the water.
Amazing.
You know, and that's been documented for over the past 10 years in the literature. So why not take the best of both? Like, I'm as woo-woo as the next person, you know. I believe broccoli can cure pretty much, you know, most of what's going on with us, and having good, happy, healthy bowel movements. And I like my nice smelling oils. But at the same time, like, if I get shot or stabbed, which is fairly unlikely where I live, but still, if I get shot or stabbed, I'm going to the hospital, I'm going to have surgery, I'm going to take the antibiotics. So I think what we have to be aware of is really taking the best of what modern medicine, mm-hmm. and then basic, you know, nutrition, healthy living and wellness has to offer as well. And again, knowing ourselves, come up with a plan that suits us. Because, you know, again, N equals one.
Yeah, I love that individualized approach. Mm. And, you know, when you've been talking, that's such good information about menopause and lifestyle. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, because when I was looking into this, it really surprised me. Say we're talking perimenopause and the changes, and we've touched on some of those main factors that people talk about, like the hot flashes, the lack of sleep, night sweats. Mm. But there's a lot of symptoms of perimenopause that are really probably not well known, like even just extreme anxiety. And like, can you tell us some of the maybe lesser known signs and symptoms of perimenopause or menopause?
Well, Grainne, I'm so glad you asked, because I prepared a list.
Yay!
So, from a physical perspective, I love a good list. I love a good list.
Oh, me too.
So, from a physical perspective, hot flushes, night sweats, bloating or digestive orders, increased body odor, particularly, you know, like armpit sweating, bone fractures, joint or muscle pain, breast tenderness, libido changes, either increased or decreased, dental or gum issues, dry, itchy skin, hair loss, weight gain, heart palpitations, headaches or migraines, disrupted sleep, itchy, twitchy legs, low energy, tired all the time, rumination or catastrophizing, panic, irritability, difficulty getting to sleep or staying asleep, brain fog, decreased concentration, anxiety, decreased confidence, depression, loss of joy, rage.
Breed.
Irregular. Yeah. Oh, that's a big one. Irregular or change in your periods, either the flow, the pain, the timing, dry or irritated vulvar tissues, clitoral or labial shrinkage, bladder leakage, pain with urination or bowel movements, recurrent UTIs or yeast infections, urinary urgency frequency, anal leakage. 1 in 5 women over 40 have anal leakage. Constipation, feelings of heaviness or a bulge in the vagina, vaginal dryness, itching, pain or bleeding with sex, and difficulty with orgasm. Fun
times.
I mean,
that's mad. Like, because I would say that the majority of the population, if they do know about menopause and do know about perimenopause, people think hot flushes. And people simply generalize the menopause as, oh yeah, that's just a period in life where people get a few hot flushes. Like, it's so minimized. And yet you just listed a list that significantly impacts a woman's quality of life. Like, you can start to see how navigating every day in their life during that time can be a very difficult process. And if anyone is suffering symptoms like that there, and you've tried the diet and lifestyle, you've tried everything you can, you do need to seek help, and you do need to seek guidance, because you don't have to suffer like this. And there is there's N equals one. Michelle said it several times. You need to get a plan that suits you.
Yeah. And you know what? It doesn't have to be either diet or lifestyle or hormone therapy.
Yeah.
It's both together.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because you have to just take the best of both. But again, like, and this is where it starts getting interesting, because people say, well, should I have a blood test to see if I'm perimenopausal? Not really. Because, like, if you're over 45 and you're having some of these symptoms, you probably are, you know, and you need to go see, like, there's been, you know, people like Louise Newson have done great jobs in terms of getting information out to GPs now. And, you know, there's free education available for every GP in the UK and Ireland.
Isn't that
again
amazing?
You know, through, it's fabulous.
Mm.
But it's not one size fits all. So, like, if you go to Primark, okay, and you buy a pair of elasticated trousers, right? So elasticated waist. They're going to fit everybody, but they're probably not going to look great. if you go to Prada or Armani and you get this tailored, bespoke, cut and measured to fit you approach, they're going to look fabulous on you. And that's what we need for women as well. We need to be able to say it's not one size fits all. Whether we're talking about pessaries, whether we're talking about contraception or hormone therapy or trousers, it's not one size fits all. It's what fits you.
Yeah.
And then you have to do some work as well. You can't just supplement away, you know, or medicate away a bad lifestyle. If you are still, you know, having your daily G&Ts, you know, you're wired and you're tired, so you need your coffee and your sugar to get going, and then you need your glass or two of wine every night to calm down, that's not sustainable long term. And we have to move our bodies as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the difficulty, because if you've got low estrogen, for example, and if you are dealing with muscle and tendon and joint issues, like I said, 1 in 4 women in their 50s will develop a gluteal tendinopathy. We see that with rotator cuff issues as well. Or if you're leaking when you're exercising, we have to look at the barriers to movement and make sure that women are given the information about the importance of finding an exercise strategy that you enjoy doing and that you will be consistent with, because you can't just take the hormone therapy and that's it. You're absolved of all responsibility. You have to be an active participant in your own health and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about if you are someone who's under 45, experiencing many of these symptoms that you've discussed?
Yeah.
What happens when you go to the GP and say, look, I think I'm perimenopausal, and they say, well, you can't be, you're not old enough yet.
I mean, here's an antidepressant.
What do you do with that? Here's an antidepressant. And sorry, I keep harping back to myself today, which is very self-indulgent, but that is exactly what's happened to me. I'm 42. I am having a plethora of those symptoms, as Grandia knows, because I moan to her frequently about them. And to be honest, the answer was, have some antidepressants. Not possible. What do I do?
Totally, totally possible. Because say you're 42, you're in the perimenopausal zone,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you need to find a GP who's just a little bit more skilled in menopausal care. Like it's literally as simple as that. Because if they're not aware, yes, everybody's talking about menopause now, but are we talking enough about perimenopause?
Making
the most of your continuing ovarian function until you stop. Like I can't remember where I read it last week, you know, but you read some of the descriptions of menopause as, you know, exhausted ovarian, you know, or ovarian failure. But like when we talk about men's health, we talk about erectile dysfunction. We don't talk about, you know, penis failure.
With a lot of terminologies in women's health, you know, incompetent, like, cervix.
Negative
and awful, failure to progress.
Failure to progress. That's women but so much.
Geriatric mother. That was,
I was one of those.
Yeah, I was one of those too, and I'm proud of it. But I would rather not have been called it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of baggage, but like I can walk into my local pharmacy if I wanted to and buy Viagra. But the hoops that we have to jump through as women to access hormone therapy,
it's bonkers.
Yeah, that's actually really, really true. Yeah.
It's just not okay. And this exactly is what happened with me. I had computer says no at the GP, and this isn't a GP bashing. They're brilliant. But
yeah,
that particular situation, that's what happened. So I did tap into the Louise Newson Clinic. I paid a stonking amount of money for an appointment, and I don't regret that, but I'm lucky that I could afford to do that. And it shouldn't be that women have to pay £300 for a 1-hour appointment to get the answers that we know and the prescriptions that we really need. And so I know the Menno charity, Louise Newson's Menno charity, is doing wonders, and it's quite wonderful. But I do think this education across the board of medical professionals, it's so desperately needed, and it has to happen now, I think.
Absolutely. And again, though, like this is where we need to start, is as women having these conversations. You know, I want to say it was Michelle Obama who said it, like that, you know, as women, the greatest service we can do for each other is to tell each other the truth.
Yeah.
You know, about what's happening with our bodies, whether we're talking about pregnancy or labor and delivery or postnatal health. But I think, you know, periods and perimenopause have, they're literally the last two outposts of conversations about women's health that I think we need to be having. And for women not to accept feeling like crap, mm-hmm. like that's not normal. Like, you know, we love to say that, you know, bladder leakage might be common, but it's not normal. But like feeling awful, it shouldn't be normal either, you know, and it can be really devastating. And then the ripples, you know, whether it's on your relationship, but also on your work or your school performance, you know, if your hormones aren't happy, if you've got something, you know, like endometriosis, for example, or if you've had a hysterectomy, and then what's happening hormonally to you at that point as well, because I still feel like hysterectomies are done super casually. You know, like, oh, we don't know what's going wrong, so let's just take the organs out and see what happens, you know. But like, if you remove a woman's ovaries, her risk of coronary artery disease, lung cancer, Parkinson's, dementia, and of course, hip fracture go through the roof, you know. But we don't talk about those, you know. And, you know, we can either get annoyed about it or we can get proactive and again, like get out there and have these conversations with, you know, like, for example, so my daughter is obviously has been home like with the pandemic, but she has no problem like sending her father in to buy, you know, pads or any sort of sanitary products when she's got her period. And this is what I want. And I want this variety, not this variety. And like, to be fair, you know, he's been well trained at this stage. Yeah, that's grand. 15 years, I couldn't imagine. Like, I love my father. I couldn't imagine having that conversation with him. So it's great to see younger women kind of embracing the normality of menstruation, you know, and to be able to acknowledge that, for example, like the traditional workday is 8 hours, you know, kind of your nine to five. And that has been based on a male hormonal cycle, because men have a 24-hour hormonal cycle. Testosterone peaks in the morning, cortisol peaks in the morning, and then fade away as the day goes on. We, in our innate superiority, are slightly more complex, and we have a 28 to 30-day cycle. But do we actually respect the ebb and flow of our hormones on how we feel throughout the month? No, because we've been trained to ignore it, you know, or medicate it away. And I think these, you know, so again, just normalizing the conversation is, as women's health professionals, is something that we have to do.
I think you're lighting up a bit of a feminist in me, Michelle. I think we have a lot of work to do here.
Am I?
Yes, you are. You are. And I really like it. But I think that I could sit and talk to you all day, and I could. Oh, I just want to take a transplant of your brain and take a chip of it, please. We're closing the season with you, and I'd really like for all our listeners for you to kind of sum up with three key things that you really want to send home from today.
Track your periods.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Track your bowel movements and don't accept feeling crappy.
I love it.
Oh God, I do love you.
I love you too.
I think we're so glad we could, and this was only one snapshot of a conversation that we could have had. Me and Emma were actually scratching our heads thinking, what will we talk to Michelle Lyons about, because we want to talk about so many things. So it just means that you're going to have to come back in season two. I'm sorry, Michelle, I'm just already going to
anytime.
It really does. But actually, that's a really that's a perfect way to sum it up. But what I think people will want more from you, from hearing you speak today. So firstly, tell us what's going on in the future. What have you got planned? And how can people find you and take advantage of your genius?
So probably going to my website is a good place to start out. So the website is called celebratemuleyeberty.com. And I always get asked, what does that mean? Muleyeberty is an old English word, and it means the art and state of being a woman. And I think we should celebrate that. So that's why it's called what it's called. Instagram is where I'm not very active on Twitter, because there's a lot of angry people on Twitter. But Instagram is where I spend a lot of time. So Michelle Lyons _Muleyeberty, mm-hmm. or you can find me on Facebook. But yeah, I'm happy to keep the conversation going, and we're better together. You know, I firmly believe that a rising tide lifts all boats, and it's by lifting each other up. And again, just destigmatizing, taking the embarrassment and the fear factor out of these conversations, we help women live well. That's our goal, isn't it?
Absolutely. 100%. Thank you for inspiring. And we cannot wait to watch this space and see what next courses you bring out, and goodness knows what else you're going to do. But thank you for your time. Because for those of you who can't see the show, she has had to sit in her car for the whole of this interview. Because a variety
the dishwasher exploded.
So thank you so very, very much.
Absolute pleasure. And can I just say thank you too for all you do as well, because not only, you know, you've got it all going on, you've got the podcast, obviously, which is a huge honor to speak on, but you know, Emma, your book is changing lives. Grania, you know, like the work that you're doing in terms of elevating our profession,
absolutely,
the publications that you've put out, the return to running guidelines. So I am completely in awe of the work that the two of you do. So I studied for this interview. Like I was a bit nervous about coming on here. So,
oh my goodness.
So bravo to the pair of you, you know, and thank you for all you do.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks, Michelle. What an incredible guest to end series one with. She's amazing, right? And if you want to find out more about Michelle Lyons, then do head to our show notes, where we have added all of her contact details and social media handles. We'd highly recommend following her and finding out more about the work she does. For now, this is the end of series one, and we want to finish by thanking you, the listener. We wouldn't be here if you weren't listening to us. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your reviews. Thank you for your feedback. And we want to say, if you are enjoying what you're listening to, please do subscribe to our channel. If you have any reviews you would like to leave, we'd be forever grateful. And of course, if there's anyone you'd like to hear from or any topics you'd like us to cover, then do contact us via Twitter, Instagram, or email. Have a wonderful summer, and Grania and I very much look forward to catching up with you in the autumn, where we'll be speaking to 10 more incredible guests. But for now, this is Emma and Grania, and we are at your service.